Hello, and welcome to the Speakeasy Podcast, part of the Cosmic Shambles Network. I'm your host, Professor Bruce Hood. Each week, we'll be showcasing three academics and highlighting their very latest research. They'll each explain their work in 3 minutes in language that any audience should be able to understand. Let's get started. I'm delighted to say that we're joined again by Dr. Kim Jacobson, who was in an earlier podcast, and I've asked her back again to comment on some of these presentations. Hi, Kim.
Hello. Thanks very much for asking me. Had a lot of fun last time. I'm looking forward to it. Shall we start?
So first up is Irene Satori from City University, who's going to talk about something I never really thought about, which is the way that our eyes filter the sunlight to protect our retina. As you're going to discover, actually, it turns out this filtering process is influenced by what we eat.
I like you very much.
Did you know that the eyes have their own internal sunglasses? Let me explain. Macular pigment is a yellow pigment located within the central retina, an area known as the macula. This area is responsible for your detailed vision. When you want to read or see a face, you turn your head so that light forms on the centre of the retina. Light travelling through the eye has to pass through a layer of this pigment before it reaches the central photoreceptors at the back of the eye. This macular pigment protects the central photoreceptors from damage from UV light, and in this way, it acts like sunglasses. Now, lower levels of macular pigment have been associated with an increased risk of developing age-related macular degeneration. This eye disease is one of the leading causes of blindness worldwide and results in an irreversible loss of central vision. Given the paucity of treatment, there's been a great deal of attention brought to developing preventative strategies. And that brings us back to macular pigment. Macular pigment is not the same as your eye colour, your skin colour, your hair colour. It comes from your diet, from foods like green leafy vegetables, yellow peppers, corn, and it's potentially modifiable through changing your diet or by taking a supplement. So this sounds like good news. We can increase our intake of these foods, boost our macular pigment levels. But it's not quite as simple as this. The amount of macular pigment and how it's distributed across the retina varies among individuals, and dietary differences only account for some 10% of the variations that we see. This leads us to my PhD study. There's been a suggestion that ethnicity plays a role, with whites presenting with lower macular pigment levels than non-whites. However, few studies have included multiple ethnic groups within a single investigation. With this in mind, I have measured macular pigment levels and its distribution in the retina in 240 individuals who are young and healthy. And I've taken these from the three largest ethnic groups in the UK. So we have white, South Asian, and black. I've also taken high-resolution retinal scans on all of these individuals to explore the hypothesis that the retinal structure may be associated with macular pigment levels. It could be that a thinner retina actually limits the storage capacity for macular pigment. The overall aim of my PhD is to evolve our understanding of macular pigment levels and how it varies, and with this in mind, may be implicated in preventing sight loss due to age-related macular degeneration.
I like you very much. I think you're grand. Why is it that when I feel a touch, my heart's not too big to be the band?
Well, that was absolutely fascinating. It turns out that what you eat can influence your vision. What did you make of it, Kim?
I thought that was really interesting. I thought as I was listening to that, how interesting that different vegetables seem to be associated with different levels of pigmentation. And what about the old wives' tale about carrots? Yeah. I wonder whether carrots could be something to do with that. I don't know. But I thought how interesting that yellow peppers and green leafy vegetables have a similar pigment that affects the macular pigmentation.
Wow, yeah. The other thing I thought was really interesting was that she was comparing different ethnic groups. And that's something, of course, that we always have to bear in mind. Mm. I mean, it must be the case in medicine that you have to, that certain groups are at risk for certain types of problems.
Absolutely right. But what's interesting is that with immigration and after people have immigrated over a long period of time, those differences can actually even out a bit. And I was also thinking whether or not the dietary difference between Southeast Asians, white British, black British might have something to do with the differences in pigmentation, and whether or not that would even out over time after different ethnic groups have been in this country for much longer.
Yeah.
Be an interesting thing to look at.
Great. Okay. So what we have up next is something which is a little bit technical, but I'm hoping that you'll be able to bring your expertise to bear upon understanding it. It's a talk by Sam Briggs from Bristol University, who's addressing, I suppose, one of the big questions.
Alive! It's alive! It's alive!
Science is about big questions. What's bigger than how did life begin? Were we flown in on the back of asteroids? Were our basic components created from gases being fused together by electrical storms and highly intense sunlight? Did the right conditions exist near deep sea thermal vents? Or is the notion put about by Darwin of creatures emerging from a warm pool the right way to think about the problem? There's another deeper problem that's implicit in the question too. How do we define life? This is a big one, but from my perspective, the perspective of a scientist trying to find criteria for investigating how life came to exist, we have these four basic points. 1. Compartmentalization, an interior environment that is distinct from its exterior. 2. Metabolism, a way of processing some sort of fuel to power itself. 3. It must be replicative, an ability to produce copies of itself. And 4. Homeostatic, an ability to maintain its own configuration. These four purposely broad criteria allow us to investigate in a top-down, removing components from modern cells until we can remove no more, but they still meet these criteria, or bottom-up, creating a system from scratch with simple components which self-assemble into a system which possesses these characteristics, ways of creating a minimal or proto-cell. The idea behind a proto-cell is that such a system is most likely to have been the first step in the journey towards modern life as we see it around us today. I work using polymers, long chains of repeating molecules that interact with an oppositely charged species of molecule to create small droplets. These droplets, known as coacervates, have no membrane, but they are distinct from their environment. Compartmentalization, tick! They have the amazing capacity to gather other molecules and objects within themselves, provided those items have the right charge or dislike water. And using this, I can add molecules that can perform reactions similar to those in modern cells. Okay, so maybe I don't have metabolism and homeostasis down just yet, but where my attention is focused is on replication, or at very least, the ability to transfer information from a mother protocell to a daughter protocell. I can use the fact that one of the two chemicals in my system forms another type of compartment upon addition of an acidic stimuli. I have found that material captured within my coacervate droplets is recovered in the new compartments after this stimulus. Now, this might not seem groundbreaking, but it's one of those very tiny steps in the right direction to answering how did all of this come to be. Of course, the wonderful thing about asking these sorts of big questions is the surprising places they lead you to. This system presents itself as a way of protecting fragile or dangerous drugs until they can be delivered to a specific site in the human body. In fact, one can exploit the fact that cancerous tumours happen to be acidic. This stimuli can trigger the release of incarcerated drugs and allow for more effective delivery of the medicine to where it is most needed in the body. So, where did life come from? I can't answer that just yet, but maybe one day we will, and maybe along the way we'll discover new technologies that can help all life to live for a bit longer.
That was Sam Briggs from Bristol University. The first thing I have to say is I thought he had an amazing voice.
He did. I could listen to him. He sounded really good, didn't he?
It was really, really complex. I have to confess, I didn't fully understand it all. But what I think he was sort of... I mean, it sounded like he was doing the basics of creating life.
I think that's probably what they are doing. They're starting at the very, very beginning to see if they can create something that almost looks like a cell that can function on its own. But I think the delivery of drugs is very interesting.
Yeah.
Because one of the problems we have with any drugs in use in medicine is not just what it does specifically, but what the side effects are and how you can minimise side effects and improve the function of the drug where you want it to be working.
Right.
So I think that's very interesting, particularly around chemotherapy, where you want to have a very active drug At the site of a cancer or a tumour, but you want to minimise the horrible side effects that people get. So good on him if that's what he's doing. That sounds like fantastic research.
Okay, so for the last presentation, we've got a winner from last year's three-minute thesis heat in Cardiff. And this is Kat Deerfield, who, by chance, I was just in Cardiff doing these recordings, and she happened to be in the office, and she volunteered to recreate her presentation from last year. And I think you should find it quite fascinating, Kim.
2, 1, boost ignition and liftoff of the Space Shuttle Discovery, returning to the space station, paving the way for future missions beyond.
One thing we all have in common is that we have all worked hard to get where we are. Imagine that it's a few years down the line, you've put in even more time, even more hard work, and you finally got the job, that job you've always dreamed of. Imagine that you arrive for your first day on this job, and you're given an apron, and your colleagues suggest that you get to work in the kitchen cooking for them. This is exactly what happened to Svetlana Savitskaya. Savitskaya was only the second woman to go to space, and the response she got from her male colleagues is sadly representative of the way women astronauts have been treated and talked about from the beginnings of the space program right up to more recent times. In my thesis, I analyzed autobiographical and media texts to answer the question, what role do cultural beliefs about gender play in the field of human spaceflight? There has been very little research on this topic to date, and my thesis aims to discover why and how women are underrepresented in the field, as well as to explore some cultural responses to these problems. The title of my thesis, Heavenly Bodies, comes from a note written on the back of a photo that once went to space. It's a photo of a woman named Dee Dee Lind, who was a popular centerfold model in the 1960s. In the photo in question, Dee Dee Lind is topless, and this topless photo went to the moon. It was hidden on board the Apollo 12 mission by the ground crew, who labeled it Map of a Heavenly Body. In a way, we could call Dee Dee Lind the first woman on the moon, and her status as a sexual object speaks to broader attitudes toward appropriate roles for women. It's worth noting that in terms of actual people, only men have ever been on the moon. But the idea of a woman traveling to the moon is at the heart of a performance art piece called The First Woman on the Moon by an artist named Alexander Mir. By creating a lunar landscape on a beach, Mir allowed members of the public to metaphorically access this place, which has only really been accessed by a few brave men. Mir's art is important to my own work because it speaks to the presence of space travel in our culture. As limited as access to space is, it is still an enormous part of our cultural reality. While there is work in the humanities and social sciences bringing feminist criticism to almost every imaginable part of culture, including science and technology, there is a noticeable lack of attention given to outer space in particular. When you have a field that originated in the mid-20th century as a predominantly male field, and then you leave it alone for 60 years, it's maybe not surprising that it doesn't get a whole lot more comfortable with women. But if we want a future of equality, my research suggests that we need to think about just what it is that we're saying when we talk about women in space.
Brings another dimension to the glass ceiling, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It's an astronomical ceiling, I suppose, is one way of thinking about it. That was Kat Deerfield from Cardiff. Now, you're a woman working in... for our listeners who can't determine that, working in medicine, and I suppose it's almost a loaded question to say, have you encountered similar problems of sexism?
Oh, absolutely. You can't be a woman in a profession without having encountered sexism at some point. I think what's interesting about medicine and the potential future for women in medicine is that in the last few years, the number of women coming into medicine is significantly higher than the number of men.
Yeah.
So how that's going to play out in the future, I don't know, but it's interesting. And the other rather sad fact is that at the other end, when you've finished your training and you're embarking on your career as an individual practitioner, the choices that women make in medicine tend to be very polarised. So you have women doing paediatrics, you have women doing general practice, and you have women doing anaesthetics. And that's because those are specialties that you can do shift work in.
Right.
Whereas the other specialties are very, very devoid of women. Neurosurgery, for example. Very, very few women in neurosurgery.
Yeah.
General surgery, there are a few more women coming up. Pathology, there are more women coming through in pathology. Mm. But the other issue also is around payment. So even today, women in medicine get paid less than men in medicine do. And that's around the merit award system, right. The you know, pat on the back for doing a good job. Far more men than women get that pat on the back.
Right. But you don't think there's any evidence that there's some sort of difference between men and women in terms of abilities? It's really to do with the structures and the opportunities.
Quite.
Yeah.
I think there's very, very little evidence at all that women do a job that is less well done than men in medicine.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose you could say physically there are some things that men are able to do slightly better, like holding up a leg for a long period of time if you're doing an orthopaedic operation.
Oh, that's a patient's leg, I take it.
A patient's leg, absolutely. And holding their own leg up. But, you know, apart from that,
Well, the evidence actually speaks quite clearly to this. For example, if you look at performance on STEM, so science, technology, engineering, maths, just looking at mathematical ability, there's no difference between boys and girls until they reach the age of puberty, adolescence, around 12 years of age. Mm. And it's at that point the various stereotypes start to kick in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is a really important point because
Absolutely.
Very often you just get this rhetoric,
yeah.
this story that women somehow are not as good in particular fields.
And why shouldn't women be neurosurgeons? They're probably slightly better with hand-eye coordination and certain things they do.
Well, careful you don't fall into another stereotype.
I may not. I may be falling into a different stereotype here, but there's absolutely no reason why they couldn't be neurosurgeons.
Yeah.
And I don't see any female neurosurgeons. I might be proven wrong. I'm sure some of your listeners will ring up and say, oh, no, hang on a minute, there is a female neurosurgeon in such and such a centre. But I have never met one.
Right. Well, look, the thing is, Speakeasy is a platform which profiles experts, and I'm pleased to say, though I can't show you explicitly here, but we're about 50% male and female. So hopefully this sort of podcast going out will encourage those listeners to be inspired, to speak out more openly about inequalities, and also if they have children, to encourage them to aspire to what they can achieve. But once again, thank you, Kim, for coming in.
Thank you very much for asking me. I will definitely come again.
Okay, I appreciate your input. It's very valuable.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Speakeasy Podcast, part of the Cosmic Shambles Network, a digital hub for curious minds. Head to cosmicshambles.com for more podcasts, documentaries, blogs, and more from the likes of Robin Ince, Josie Long, Helen Chersky, and Brian Cox, and many, many more. Speakeasy is a platform designed to connect expert speakers with audiences. If you'd like to check out the profiles of any of the people featured in today's show, head over to speakeasy.org. See you all next time.